The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. Can you hear me okay? So, for the last month, I was teaching the month-long meditation retreat at Spirit Rock, a retreat center up in Marin County. And that's a beautiful, profound process for people to be able to go for 1 month, sit in silence, basically in silence most of the time, and meditate throughout the day. Everyone has a short period of work they do every day to keep the place going. And it's a privilege to be able to teach this retreat and to support people and track them as they go through the various cycles, what happens on these long retreats. I think it's one of the great things to do for a lifetime is to, you know, once in a lifetime you should go to Mecca or something like that. Once a lifetime to go do something like a month-long retreat, if you can, but just once. It's quite a phenomenal thing to be able to step so radically out of our normal life, not only what we normally do, but even out of what we normally think, you know, our normal habits of how we live our life, think, and behave. And instead, let the mind, the heart, get quieter so that it can see really deeply. So you can really start seeing what's going on in deeper, deeper levels. And there's a wonderful reciprocity where we get quiet a little bit. You stop talking, for example, and you sit with that, and you start seeing more deeply what's going on in your mind. And as you see more deeply, that can support getting quieter. As you get quieter, it helps you to see more deeply. And then you get quieter. And you see more deeply what's going on. And, you know, they're kind of the deeper, deeper levels, kind of parts of the mind where you never, you know, never visit because, you know, usually we operate and only see what's the surface mind, kind of what's going on. And it's quite a surprise for people to be able to drop deeply down and find out what makes them tick. And to also find out, as the surface mind, as the preoccupations of the mind quiet down and the mind gets quieter, how much beauty there is, how much freedom there is, how much compassion and love there can be. That's almost like feels like it just resides there. It's just kind of in the heart. All it needs is time and space to be revealed. And it's quite something to feel what's present there. So I was there for the last month, and it's kind of like a little bit of a Dharma feast. And I feel in a wonderful way, maybe, I don't know if saturated is the right word, or I feel kind of, by the end of the retreat, I thought, what could I possibly say? You know, the mind gets quieter and quieter, more peaceful, more content, more just at ease. So at this deep contentment and ease, some people, the teaching that you don't have to do, all you got to do is be, becomes very important. You sit there and be. And anytime you start to do something, it just seems too much because there's such deep sense of well-being just to be present. And meditation practice becomes less and less doing and more being. And as a teacher going through it, I also kind of go through similar cycles. So that's a very wordy way of saying that I don't have a need to say anything. It just, you know, teachers have to say whatever they're going to say with a lot of words. But so I kind of feel kind of complete and, you know, what is there to say, you know, nothing to do. So I apologize. I guess, you know, if you're here waiting for something. One of the little truisms in this practice is that if you're waiting for something, you've missed the boat. So that is sitting here waiting. It's just the old way, old habit of the mind, that wanting something or something and wanting to get something useful or to have something happen. And in this kind of place where the mind gets very quiet, very peaceful, you can feel that's leaning forward, wanting something to happen, expecting something to happen, waiting for something to happen. on all kinds of levels. It's just too much. It's just, you know, why bother behaving that way? And so, you know, it's a waste of time to be waiting for something to happen. For people who don't live in this quiet place, it's we often live in an acquisitive mind. We want things, we want experiences, we want knowledge, we want something, or we don't want something. And this wanting and not wanting is kind of so strong and operating so much. And it's so much the normal pattern of life, and it's so maybe dealing with life which is so uncomfortable or a mind which is uncomfortable, that it seems completely reasonable to you. You want something that's going to support you, something that's going to help you, something that's going to avoid more discomfort. So the mind that wants and expects is, you know, still operating. But as this, you know, practice goes deeper, you realize you don't have to wait for anything. Nothing has to happen. So you show up and the teacher doesn't want to say anything. And that's okay, you know, as opposed to, you know, demanding your money back, you know. It's okay too. So I apologize for those of you who think this, but all this little speech I gave is really strange. Because maybe it's very foreign to how you have lived life, and so it maybe doesn't quite compute. And if that's the case, great. Because maybe it stretches you or kind of suggests there's another way of looking at life. You kind of can question yourself and stuff like that. So what I thought, instead of me giving a talk, I could try to answer some of your questions. Maybe if you have something you would like to ask, and maybe then I would have some more words. Yes, please. If you can wait for the mic, that way everyone can hear.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes. Hello. Thank you.
In terms of what you said about the acquisitive mind wanting something or not wanting something, where would you place wanting something from inside yourself, like a creative impulse?
Wanting something.
The creative impulse, wanting to bring something forth from yourself. Is that a wanting or a not wanting or something else?
It's a great question. Very nice. First, before I answer that question, I want to say that, you know, wanting and not wanting is not a bad thing automatically. Wanting peace, wanting not to hurt more, wanting not to have more suffering is a good thing. It's a good desire to have. So, you know, if a mind is suffering a lot, wanting to be relieved of that is something, it's a healthy thing to have. But as, you know, as the mind gets quieter, more peaceful, as there's less suffering here, that want, that desire doesn't have to be there. And what we find is that, many people find, is that the mind gets quieter and the acquisitive mind or the aversive mind is no longer operating. The doubtful mind, the fearful mind is no longer operating. And it's more okay, in a sense, just to be. Nothing has to happen, just to be there, without expectation, without desires, that there's a different level, a different aspect of the mind or the heart, the inner life that can operate. And so some people will call that intuitive, some people creative. The human mind will still operate in a quiet, relaxed place. And so what flows out of it that is not a reaction to the world or reaction to our angers or our fears or our greed or all those things. It can sometimes be quite beautiful. Some people find that it's very creative. Like for me, it was after living in a Zen monastery for a year, I lived in a monastery for 3 years, that I started doing poetry and started doing art and started doing sculpture. Because, not because I wanted to exactly, not in the way that I'd wanted things before. It wasn't like I wanted to do these things. It started just flowing from me. And so it was more a matter of getting out of the way for the flow of this creative process than it was to, you know, want to do it. And so what I call this, or I haven't coined this word, But there's a beautiful term called trust emergence. Trust what emerges. And so at some point in life, when we don't have to operate from worry, we don't have to operate from planning, we don't have to operate from controlling the situation and having everything set up just the way we want it, but rather we can relax and settle back, and we can trust what emerges out of our peaceful heart. And we don't have to be prepared, because what comes is fine by itself. So there's what you're talking about, the creative impulse maybe, can be part of that. Is this what you're talking about? Is that close enough, or you want to ask more specifically? What was your... This is to the point of your question?
I'm not sure. Excuse me. I'm not sure in myself if I understand what that impulse really is, and sometimes it feels like a wanting, you know. Uh-huh. And
it can be.
Other times it feels like a flow, and
it can be. It can be.
I almost wish it weren't there.
I see. It can be either one, and it can be both at the same time. Because, for example, I'll tell you, my at one point when I was in college, I started. I was tricked by my roommate. I had a born again artist for a roommate, and so he kind of tricked me into starting to draw and do art, and I got more and more into it, and eventually took drawing classes and painting class, and then I decided I was going to be an art major so I can get into the classes you couldn't otherwise get into, and then one day I decided I was an artist, and that was the day I stopped doing art. Because then the thing about doing art came out of the desire for the identity, that to fulfill the identity. And that wasn't the right motivation. I just couldn't get myself to do it for that reason. So not a few artists, for example, complicate their creative flow by identifying with themselves as an artist, or trying to prove themselves or get accolades from other people. And so it gets tied up with egotistical desires, for example. So there's definitely desire, but the creative impulse of what emerges might be just a weaker part of that. And there's I like to think of that some of the more meaningful aspects of the human heart, human mind, tend to be kind of shy or quiet. And so if we're living a mental life which is quite loud, very much preoccupied by things, reacting to things, wanting things, in conflict with things, then that what's quiet inside of us doesn't have a chance to be heard. And so, and then other desires tend to operate. The loud desires tend to be more reactive and egotistical. So hopefully that, you know, gets in the territory of your question. Thank you. Yes.
Can you elaborate on a human being's need for identity? Like to fit into.
Why don't you tell me what you mean by the need for identity?
Right. So, I feel sometimes an internal as well as sometimes an external pressure to fit into professional identity.
Oh, yeah.
And that, I sometimes feel that's like pressure.
Okay, so let me start with the external one. People, you find other people expect you to have a professional identity.
Right.
Yeah, how does that work?
I just feel pressured.
Like that?
Yeah.
They just vibe you, or they say
certain
things?
Yeah, and that identity is also comes with some expectation for success.
So it's like family, identity. Friends, or even society.
Yeah,
it comes along with that. You know, you're supposed to have this kind of success. You're supposed to be this way. Your friends, they have success in the world, and they talk about their success, and you're just like kind of like happily going along, but you have nothing to talk about, because you didn't get a promotion, and you don't have stock options, and you spent the day at the beach. So you feel the pressure like that?
Yes, and it's sometimes like it's talked about, and sometimes it's subtle.
Yeah. So the interesting question is, so how do you understand that when the pressure comes your way? It's all true?
Sorry?
You believe it all?
So I go through all the degrees of it. Like, yeah. Sometimes I completely believe and, like, you know, I sort of crouch. And sometimes, you know, I'm in the middle somewhere. Yeah. And sometimes I'm able to... Uh-huh. Not really take any pressure and just kind of enjoy my life.
Fascinating. So what's happening inside of you when you believe the pressure that's different from what's happening inside of you when you don't?
It's a little more complicated than that.
Oh, explain. Explain. I want to learn from you how this works.
The people that have inspired me in my life and who I respect, those who I've never met and those who I have, it seems like their life has been pretty unplanned. But there's this deep sense of surrender and honesty to their truth. And that's how they've lived. And that inspiration sort of really relieves me from that pressure.
Ah, nice. So when you have models that you can, models of a different way of living, that relieves you.
Yeah.
But when you don't have those models or they're not close by, then the example of the people who are professionally successful, somehow you get hooked in that, or you kind of believe that that's what's important.
Right, and I see both as important. Like, I think professionally successful is not a bad thing.
No.
It's a perfectly fine thing. But I feel like being true to what is inside you is something more precious to me.
So the interesting question, though, maybe professional success is fine, but we're talking about the pressure. You're feeling a pressure from other people that you're supposed to have professional success. So what happens inside of you that you get hooked to that pressure? That you buy into it, or you feel the pressure, enough that you get concerned and like, what should I do? And I better do it.
Yeah, so it really also affects the meditation practice, because here I am like putting in thousands of hours of retreat time.
Yeah,
and it really doesn't go anywhere, right? Like, it's like personally, I feel benefited from it.
Professional meditator.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to get a PhD at the end of it, or I'm not, you know, it's just, I'm sitting.
So the question is for you, so someone comes along and has all this pressure, you know, so you better become a professional something, professional meditator, you know. Gail looks at me and he thinks I should become a professional meditator. And you feel the pressure. What's the hook? What's going on inside of you that you get hooked, that you get taken by it, or that you buy into that pressure? What's your response? Because what's your responsibility here?
So I think the only hook I do get, I buy into, is generally like the hook of responsibility.
Ah, good.
And that's often a good one. So like, making the money that I need to, and all of those things.
To take care of yourself.
And yeah, and, you know, people close to me wherever I'm needed. So, yeah.
So responsibility is your hook. It's my hook, too. It's my Achilles heel. Mm-hmm. You know, to I'm responsible and something. It's a dangerous one to have. But, so for you, it's, at times, responsibility is a good thing, but responsibility is that little thing that gets you to causes that pressure to influence you, to affect you?
Yeah, so responsibility coupled with planning for future.
Uh-huh. So when is responsibility healthy for you to feel, and when is responsibility and planning for the future problematic?
That's the line that seems like, how much do you plan for future, right? Because you can potentially like have $500,000-$700,000 in your bank and feel you planned well. Or you might feel you haven't.
So what I'm trying to do with you, if I may, is I'm trying to find out where is the clinging, where is the holding that you're doing that's making a problem out of this pressure that you're feeling. Because if you only let it be the pressure in the world, like get those people away, and only then will I be happy. Then you're not really taking responsibility in a good, healthy way for how you take on the... So, for example, one way to take on other people's pressure is the hook would be you want people to like you. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that someone won't like you is so frightening, so difficult, that you buy into the pressure. That's one possibility, you know. Another thing is you put the other person in such level a position of authority that they must really know, and you're just a little person who doesn't know anything. And so, well, this person knows, I don't know, and I better kind of give in to what's the person who's powerful. There's all kinds of hooks inside of you, because pressure coming from someone else is only pressure if you buy into it.
Right.
So what happens in you? What's happening in you when you buy into it?
There is an aspect of wanting to be liked and respected. Uh-huh. I think that's there. As I said, it's complicated. I can write down so many emotions that are floating through me, even right now as I inquire into it.
Yeah. So the practice of mindfulness, the path of mindfulness, is to do that very thing. To inquire deeply into what is actually going on in you in relationship to this perceived pressure, and to find, and that's where the key is how it meets what it meets inside of you, and how you get caught by it, and it's inside of you that you can learn how to get uncaught by it, and the same thing when the pressure comes from inside of you, we have all these voices in a sense inside. That give us pressure. We've internalized some of the societal pressure, and we have our own pressures that come. And then, what's the hook inside of us that we buy into the pressure? That's the essence of what needs to be investigated here.
Right. That's quite helpful to start with. Yeah.
And you talked about thousands of hours or days, or I don't know what you said, of meditation practice. I don't know you well enough to know how this works for you. But I've known people who've used meditation kind of as an escape. And it makes their life more peaceful because they don't have to go to work. And so as long as they have that kind of peace, everything's good. Or sometimes you can get kind of blissed out and meditating and stuff. And some people have that ability to get kind of, and they use it as an escape rather than a support to look more deeply. And so they go back into their ordinary life after meditation, and it's just as difficult as it was before, and they don't quite understand this meditation is not helping. That's what meditation is supposed to help. Just getting calm and peaceful is not helpful. What's helpful is to have insight, understanding of how we tick, how we operate, and learn how to let go of the things that hook us and pull us around by our nose into what's going on around us. So there has to be some point. There has to be that looking. So that's why the combination of going and meditating and getting quiet, that in itself is not enough. It's getting quiet so we can use that quiet place to look more honestly at what's really happening. Does that make some sense?
Sure.
Well, thank you. Thank you for going along with this. I was hoping it'd be useful for everyone else too.
Yeah,
the hearing system device is working. Other people, that yours is working. Yeah, so it's your machine which is not working. So try getting another one.
Here, take mine. I have a question.
Yes.
I'm on. Okay. Most of us make large commitments in our lives. In fact, all of us do. Family and, business. And a lot of times, you move into these commitments and they're pretty overwhelming. I was actually thinking about you and I was going, I just came back from retreat, and it's feeling cool.
I apologize.
Yeah. And I'm not feeling that way right now. I'm having a lot of trouble in the business I started. So I was thinking about you, and I said, you know, actually, the guy has, he's established this center, he's established this new retreat, and I was thinking, you know, he's been through a lot of pressure, and he does not show it. And I imagine just, you know, your family, too. So I suppose it's a comment, but I would be interested in knowing how you've handled these things. I would think establishing the retreat center would have been tough. You know, you had to go get the capital, go get the building, and you go, geez, I don't know if that's going to be. And this means me thinking what you're thinking, which is, how do you know it's going to work?
Yes.
You know? Okay.
So you have commitment, responsibilities, and this complicated life, and you know, this guy who just came from retreat and just kind of like, you know, just everything's cool. You know, he probably doesn't have any responsibilities. It's probably an unreal life that he lives and, you know, it has nothing to do with my life. I don't know if this counts to get a little bit more credibility here then. I drove 3.5 hours today to fulfill the responsibility that I had to do. I went back to Spirit Rock today. I was there Friday, left Friday after being there kind of for a month. And there was a meeting up there I had to go to, and so I drove all the way up there and all the way back. It took 3.5 hours the whole trip to fulfill that responsibility. I think that responsibility and commitment are to some degree a normal part of most people's lives, and the opportunity with these things is to use them as your monastery. So traditionally in Buddhism, for example, someone who's a serious practitioner would go off and become a monk or a nun, which is a life of commitment and responsibility. And it's a very serious commitment because it has particular rules, precepts that live by, and responsibilities to your teacher and to your elders and to your job in the monastery. And it isn't just kind of living, kind of, you know, sitting quietly looking out at the veranda, you know, at the, you know, the world going by. And the art of all this is to take on the responsibilities that we have to take on, accept the commitments that we've chosen to make, in order to work on ourselves, to see ourselves, to see where our edges are, to see where our expectations, our fears are, to see where our desires are, to feel where our frustrations are, and really look at it and work with it and be present for it, to see that if we can slowly, maybe quickly, free ourselves from all the attitudes which are extra, all the things which are not needed. So, like, for example, a common responsibility and commitment that some people have, someone in your life had this commitment and responsibility once upon a time, and that is the responsibility of being a parent. We have a responsibility and commitment to take care of these kids the best we can. But I saw myself when my kids were small that I was trying to fulfill that commitment best I could when my kid decided to have a fit in a supermarket because they couldn't get that box of, you know, candy. And they're having like this, it looks pretty ugly. I mean, screaming and yelling and crying and tears and, you know, from all practical purposes, you know, I must be like the parent from hell, and probably the supermarket is going to call Children's Protective Services, because who could have a kid who's going to is, you know, that upset and, you know, on the floor, pounding the floor, and, you know, so here I'm trying to fulfill my commitment and my responsibility to be a parent, right? And I'm concerned about all these people. I think I'm a terrible parent, and boy, they must think really badly of me, and I'm a meditation teacher. I should know better, and so there's an example where I'm trying to fulfill my commitment, trying to figure out what to do, but it's entangled with what I'm worried about what other people are going to think about me, and that makes it more complicated, right? And then I get part of the exhaustion is not dealing with the kid, but the exhaustion is all the extra kind of attitudes, identities, fears, concerns we have in relationship to it. So So how do we enter a commitment in such a way we become a better person through it? How do we enter a commitment so that the commitment means that we don't easily find a way out? We don't just avoid what's going on, but we feel the limitations, we feel the attitudes we have that might be extra. And we learn to find a way to let go of all the things which are not needed and learn to find our ease with our responsibility and commitment. How to do them in a serious way, but not be weighed down by them. For me, one of the places I really started discovering this for myself was when I was started Buddhist practice living in monasteries, because there was a lot of your life is very limited there, and you have certain all kinds of restrictions living in a community, living with a schedule, living with responsibilities, and it wasn't always easy. It was often wasn't easy. But all this stuff came up, and I had to look at myself in a way that I could never, and forced to look at myself, if I didn't have those responsibilities and commitments in community life, because I could have just turned on the TV before, right? Just, things aren't going so well, you turn on the TV. Things aren't going so well, you drink some alcohol. Things are not going so well, you know, you go do something, right? And just avoid it. But when you have a commitment, you're not supposed to avoid, you're supposed to meet it. And if you meet it if you have a mindfulness practice and you meet it as a way to explore and see yourself deeply, then you start working out the rough edges or working out the ways in which that add stress as we do it. And so by the time that we were getting ready to create this place, IMCE and the retreat center, I had a fairly good ability. Say it a little bit differently. I'd come to the place where I just wasn't interested in doing these things in a stressful way. In fact, I didn't want to have a retreat center if it was going to be very stressful to have it. It had to have some ease in making it happen. Otherwise, well, you know, why bother? You know, we didn't have to have a retreat center. It was not required. We didn't have to have IMC. We don't have to have IMC. So I feel there's some commitment and responsibility to having this place, and I try my best to fulfill that commitment, and it requires many things. Tomorrow we have a board meeting, and you can come if you want to see what goes on, and we'll rope you in, get you committed and responsible. And so tomorrow evening, I hear, we'll have our board meeting, and so I'll go to that. So I think, you know, I try to do this responsibly in a committed way, but one of the ways I'm protected from being caught in that is I'm very clear that IMC does not have to exist. You know, I don't feel like I have to hold on to this place for dear life. Like, you know, it's we you know, try our best to make it work nice for people. And if that's if it works nice, great, we're happy. And since it's very meaningful for me, very inspiring for me to be part of this and make the practices and the teachings this place available for people, I find a lot of meaning from it, it's great, I'm happy. And if for some reason it can't happen and you all never come back and, you know, we can't keep it going, it's okay. There's other things to do. I don't mind. I don't feel like any. So I'm not holding on, right? So that helps to do the commitment. With more ease. So I hope that long explanation is okay.
We'll be back.
You'll be back. So we have, maybe one or two questions more if you'd like. And
I could really relate to that question and answer. I'm a terrible parent too. No, my question is sort of about making a commitment to oneself. I'm relatively new to mindfulness practice, and when I was practicing regularly, I found it very, very beneficial for myself. But I haven't been here in a couple of months because somehow, as my own personal commitments kind of piled up, it was the first thing that fell off of my schedule.
Yeah.
And I sort of felt my stress level ratcheting up after that happened. And I could acknowledge to myself that by not continuing the practice that I was finding beneficial, I was kind of trading off my own sort of general and long-term well-being for sort of these short-term commitments that were of arguable importance.
Yeah.
So I'd be curious to hear if you have any advice about sort of forming lasting habits that about around a commitment to oneself to sort of engage in this practice fully.
Yeah. So I'll give you a little, maybe a teeny example of something for me when I was teaching this retreat up there. It's a big deal. To teach these retreats is kind of a big deal. It's kind of intense. I get the impression, it was all calm and peaceful and how nice it was, right? Gil's on a vacation. But it's a big responsibility. It's a little bit intense to be a teacher. You meet with people one-on-one a lot. It's all kinds of things. So in order to manage in a balanced way up there, I decided I need to go for a good hike up the mountain every day. And so I made a commitment to do that. And there was a lot of reasons why I shouldn't do it on many days. And for the first 2 weeks I was there, no debates were allowed. I just went. And just the going and doing just made... And then the third week, the other demands started to creep in. And so I got to go half the days. And then the last week I didn't go at all because by that time the needs of Spirit Rock became so big that I couldn't get away. But it was so clear what was going on. So that's a little example of, what goes on. So in the beginning it worked because I made a real commitment. No debates, just this is what I do. I think let's assume that the other responsibilities are important. You said arguably important. Let's say they assume they're important. I think for many people, a wise life has to involve a clear discernment and choice between all the different healthy options or important options that our life presents us. And we have to look at that and see in the bigger picture what is most healthy for everyone concerned. And so if you end up being stressed because you're fulfilling all these responsibilities, and then you're taking that stress out on your kids, you might be fulfilling some of your responsibilities, but in the long term, you're not going to create healthy kids. And so you see, maybe I have to let go of some things. Maybe I can't do certain things that are important to do. Or maybe I have to make extra effort. I have to develop a stronger resolve that no matter what, I'm going to do things that I need to do and figure out what not to do because I don't really need to do that. So, I don't know you, right? So I'm not saying this. You do this. But not a fair number of people that I know who have computers now and do a fair amount of things on the computer that doesn't need to be done. They're searching, they're checking, they'll just check the news, And a committed life is one that actually has a very honest look at what we actually do with our lives and is able to whittle away the wasted time or the necessary things or things that don't really nourish us and be committed to the things that are important and nourish us. And without that kind of clear decision-making, it's going to be hard. So I don't know if that responded to your question with enough.
Very helpful. Thank you.
So I saw your hand, Jim. If I'm capable of a short answer, you could ask.
Well, mine is about the calm you talked about.
Yeah.
I just came off a weekend retreat.
Yes.
And when I calmed down at the beginning, I had trouble holding my mind, monkey mind. And then as I got calmer, though, I kept falling asleep or nodding off.
Yes.
And it wasn't until, the last day I got a lot of tea, and strong tea, and suddenly I was able to not fall asleep, and I was able to get back and stay with the breath a lot better. So I think my sense of what was really calm isn't really right, because I guess it's not a calm that's incompatible with the tea.
Yeah.
It's
there's a lot to say on that question of energy and tiredness and how to work with all these things. The calm needs to be balanced with the appropriate amount of energy. And if there's too much calm and not energy to balance it out, people tend to get drowsy or dull or even fall asleep. If you have too much energy but without calm, it tends to be agitating. So how do we get just the right balance? I mean, a lot of people in America are sleep-deprived. We have a sleep-deprived culture. And a lot of people in this culture here need sleep more than they need meditation. And so it's possible, some people come to a retreat with a sleep deficit, and they need the first few days in order to just kind of recover from that and get back to a kind of more normal, healthy kind of sense of clarity. And when a weekend retreat, you don't have those few days. You have to, it takes a few days, maybe the end of the retreat to kind of come over the hump like that for some people. So next time you go, you might make sure you get a lot of sleep the week before you go, if that was your case. The other is that sometimes people are not used to getting calm. And so when they get calm, the only thing they know, their system knows what it's like, is to go to sleep. And so it's a matter of getting used to it. And if a little bit of caffeine for a while kind of helps you be calm and energized, maybe that's a good kind of temporary solution. As you get, again, learning the territory of calm and learning to stay alert and awake and calm, as opposed to being lulled by it into kind of sleep. The other thing that happens is that sometimes sleep and retreat is not because of sleep deprivation, but rather is from psychological exhaustion. And sometimes we go through, maybe you got all the sleep you needed, but as we get quieter, the mind gets quiet. It's like layers in the mind. And as we go through the layers, we discover a layer that's exhausted from a lifetime of hard work. Because the frontal mind is, some parts of the mind are working overtime all the time. Like some people who are anxious or afraid, the fear is like, it never got a vacation. And so they come to that layer of fear, and they finally feel it and see it the first time in their life, and they're so and just exhausted, and for a while they just can't hardly move around. They just feel so tired, and they're just because of that layer they've reached, and then they have to kind of work through that layer. And there's a lot of reasons for the tiredness. So the only thing I think I'd like to tell you is not a direct answer to your question, is that. Dealing with tiredness and the balance of tiredness, calm, and energy and all that is part of what most people have to deal with on retreat. But never be discouraged by being tired on retreat. Chances are something important is going on for you. Something important is healing or working through or something. It's never wasted time. So even if the whole weekend you were tired, something is working itself out that needs to happen. Okay, so I hope that was okay for you. Those of you who are waiting for something, I hope you got something. And thank you for letting me come here today and doing it this way, because I certainly appreciate and enjoyed coming here sitting with you. It's always nice to do. And the fact that I didn't really feel like giving a talk, and we did this instead, I thank you for going along with that.